From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan's Redistricting Commission asks for more time.
There will be some delay. Everybody is doing their best to make sure that everything happens as quickly as humanly possible in the process.
Also, one writer considers personal and public tragedies while delivering water to folks in Flint.
Going to Flint and spending the time that I spent there allowed me to start to look at some things about my family that I don't think I had really wanted to look at.
And photojournalist Amy Sacca captures warmer winters on the lakes, starting with her dad.
About 4 years ago, I started to go out with him on the ice and photograph what he was up to and talk to other ice anglers on the ice. And I really saw Midwestern culture come to life.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a photographer talks about capturing warmer winters in the Great Lakes. You'll hear that later in today's show. But first, Michigan's Independent Redistricting Commission is seeking more time to redraw the state's political maps, citing expected delays in the release of U.S. Census data, data that will be essential to the commission's work. Joining us now is Sue Hammersmith, Executive Director of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Sue, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. I'm so pleased to be back on the program.
The commission has decided to hire a firm based in Virginia to help draw the district maps. Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship between the firm and the commission? I mean, what are the things that the commission cannot do itself that the contractor might be able to accomplish?
So there aren't too many citizens who have the capabilities and the software to actually draw maps for the districts that will be required through the process. So the commission felt it was best to seek an independent contractor to provide the mapping services, and they have chosen Election Data Services out of Virginia for this service.
There was some concern among commission members about this specific firm, that the firm has a reputation for drawing districts that look like a Picasso painting. Has that concern been resolved?
This is the group that has been hired, and it is the job of the commission then to make sure that the lines are drawn fairly and in a nonpartisan manner. So they did bring a team of both Republicans, Democrats, and also an independents to the table, and they have said that all three will be working on maps. And again, the commission's job is to make sure the maps are drawn in a fair and a transparent manner. So they will be upholding that end of the Constitution to make sure this really happens.
There have been some major concerns expressed about the timing of the U.S. Census results, which are going to be coming in late this summer, and the commission's constitutional obligation to draw new districts by a deadline not long after that in September. How big of a concern is the discrepancy in those dates right now?
April, it's a big enough concern that the commission voted on Friday to seek relief from this deadline from the Supreme Court. And here's the reason. The census data is supposed to come in on September 30th. The commission is supposed to have final maps drawn by November 1st. However, there's a 45-day comment period, which goes back to September 17th, which would in essence require the maps to be drawn by September 17th. And that is an impossibility without having the census data, which has now been delayed twice. First from April 1st to July 30th, and then from July to the September 30th date. So they've made it a difficult process for the commission. But in the meantime, we have a lot of work to do. So we're going to be holding first our public hearings before our first line is drawn. So that's really important that we want people to engage in public hearings throughout the state, and for people to engage in any kind of public comment. They can go to our website, they can come to a commission meeting and provide public comment. So that's the most important thing right now. So we're going to focus on what's most important and all the steps that we need to take and that we can take prior to getting the census data.
The method through which the commission asked for a reprieve was by making this request to the state Supreme Court. Could you run us through sort of the gist of the argument? Is it just sort of to say that there was something like an act of God in the delay of the census response this year, and we just need more time?
We haven't yet filed with the Supreme Court. Our legal counsel got permission to file with the Supreme Court, and that is all that has been done to date. More details will follow on that as the commission and general counsel work out the plan to seek this relief from the date that is really impossible to meet.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the process as it stands. Walk us through what's going to be happening with the public meetings.
The public meetings are being scheduled in May and June. They will be scheduled throughout the state. The commission has not yet determined a final list of locations. The Constitution, however, requires at least 10 public meetings before any maps are drawn. So we will meet that minimum criteria and do our best to go above and beyond to seek input in as many communities and from as many people as possible. This is really a citizens-driven process, and we want to make sure that people give their input, especially around the area of communities of interest. So if there's a cultural or historical or economic group that doesn't want to be divided up into different districts, they need to come forward and tell us this is really important to us, and we want to make sure when the maps are drawn that our community of interest is included in those maps as a whole unit that can vote together on what we feel is important to us.
And then what will the plan of action be once the census data finally is released?
Interestingly enough, it's just like we can't get to work the next day. There are details that need to be worked into the plan by the state of Michigan. So, for example, they will overlay the census data on voting data. So there's lots of things that need to happen before we can actually get to the mapping process. So there will be some delay. Everybody is doing their best to make sure that everything happens as quickly as humanly possible in the process.
I'm starting to see why you wanted to make that request for a delay. Once the lines are drawn, Sue, as we look down to the later stages of the process, do you anticipate there will be a time when the public, or I guess even elected officials, can lobby their complaints or concerns about the maps as they're proposed?
According to the Constitution, once the lines are drawn, there's supposed to be a 45-day public comment period and also 5 public hearings at a minimum that the commission will host. So there is more input after the maps are drawn, and then the commission would need to meet again in an open and transparent meeting, open to the public, that they can have further discussion based on more input.
I know that there's not a lot of latitude in how this process was initially described and set into motion. You know, it wasn't the commission's choice to work on the timeline that it has. How is everybody involved in this feeling about the likelihood of maps being drawn in such a way that will make it that will make them useful for people who are running elections in the years to come?
We actually had the director of the Bureau of Elections meet with the commission on March 5th to have this discussion because people need to file for primaries by April 19th and an upcoming election. So there's a very tight timeline there, and we're going to work with the Michigan Department of State and the Bureau of Elections so that we can mutually meet our deadlines as best possible. So it's quite a balancing act. Typically, it takes 6 months from census data for the Bureau of Elections to get ready. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in compressed time frames, but we feel that by working together, we can achieve more than going our separate ways. So we are working with Bureau of Elections and the Department of State to make sure that future elections can be held with the new districts drawn and in a fair and most transparent process.
There's something that people may be aware of, that the U.S. Census releases all kinds of data throughout the year. Of course, there is the big count that happens every 10 years, but there are different types of data and data analyses that can be done just about any time. Is any of that information of use to the commission in its process?
It may help with the work, and certainly I believe commissioners will be engaging in exercises to utilize that data. I'm not sure how it will pan out as far as the final maps. I mean, we can use the American Community Survey data as one tool to look at mapping, but we honestly don't know if that's a good indicator of what the 2020 census will look like or not. So, again, we will have to wait until that final data is available to us in order to draw the maps.
This is quite an unusual situation in what was already something of a new experiment for Michigan, and a lot of pressure, frankly. How's everybody on the commission getting along?
I would say the commissioners have done quite a good job of making sure that once decisions are made, they move on, of being respectful to each other, of trying to make sure that the best job is done for the people of Michigan. So I think everybody's committed to the goal, which is most important, and that is fair lines are drawn for future elections. So I think that commitment to the goal will be the, if you will, the saving grace of this commission of 13 randomly selected people who were engaged together in this process.
Many of our communities in Michigan are divided by different understandings of what's going on in America right now. And there are still some people holding to misinformation, disinformation, or outright lies about the election being stolen. Has that been much of an issue among the members?
I don't believe that's been any issue among the members. Again, they understand that their goal is to create nonpartisan maps. And I see that expressed by everybody, no matter which party they're from or whether they're an independent. They are committed to the task ahead of them, and I don't see them veering from committing to the task of drawing nonpartisan fair maps for Michigan.
Sue Hammersmith is the executive director of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Sue, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, April.
Next on the show, we meet a Michigan author who wrestled with two catastrophes simultaneously, the public trauma of the Flint water crisis and the personal trauma of his mother's final illness and death. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Before I introduce you to our next guest, I want to remind you about something. We're preparing a show this week about how our relationships have changed during the pandemic. We're talking about your friends, your family, your spouse, or your squeeze, or even just total strangers. We suspect you've got some stories to tell, and we would love to hear them. You can email them to us. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can call and leave us a voicemail. I'm going to give you the number. It's 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Or if you're a little tech savvy, why not record yourself on your phone and then send it to us? You can share it to our email address. One more time, that's stateside@michiganradio.org. You'll be hearing this show coming up later in the week. About 7 years ago, writer David Harden was coping with his elderly mother's illness. He and his mom had a pretty complicated relationship, and he wasn't sure if he'd made peace with their lifelong cycles of need and alienation. At the same time, Harden, an award-winning poet who lives in Oakland County, was becoming aware of what was going on in Flint as the water crisis was exploding across the front pages and into the national consciousness. David Harden subsequently went to Flint as a Red Cross volunteer to deliver water, and his reflections during that period, marrying the desolation with his mother's death with the public devastation in Flint, come together in his new memoir called Standpipe. David Harden, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. I'm really happy to be here.
So the book is about this trip that you took to Flint as you were sort of thinking on and processing your mother's illness and death and the relationship that you two had in her lifetime. How would you describe your relationship with your mom?
I won't say it was difficult, and I won't even say it was complicated. We lived apart for many years. She was from Tennessee. She moved to Michigan with my father. They lived here for many years, and then she moved back to her hometown after my father passed away. So I didn't see her a lot for a good 15 years, but we weren't very close. We were superficially close, but it always felt to me like there was some a wide gulf between us that we could never quite bridge.
You two were very close when you were small, I think as a lot of us are with our parents.
Yeah.
Where had you two gotten to by the time she was closing in on the end of her life?
Well, we had come full circle. I mentioned it in the book, but it suddenly dawned on me. It hit me like a ton of bricks, actually. I realized that I really needed her. And at the time, I was in my late 50s, and she was in her 80s. And again, we had been apart for a long time. But it really struck me when she became ill and started to deteriorate. I realized that I really needed her and badly wanted to be with her and to try. I guess I didn't understand it at the time, but I really wanted to try to bridge that gulf between us.
This was all spooling out at the time when the Flint water crisis was unfolding publicly.
Yes.
Which I just want to make a little delineation there between what was happening in the Flint water crisis and when most of the world found out about it. And there were many, many people watching TV and hearing the updates and just feeling helpless, not knowing what to do.
Yes.
What made you, at the time you were in this intense emotional space about your mother, what made you decide to volunteer for the Red Cross to deliver water in Flint?
She died in September of 2015, and I had been listening to the reports off and on, but I, to be honest, I wasn't completely focused on them. I was really dealing with her death, her impending death. Then once she was gone, I happened to be home recovering from some surgery that wouldn't allow me to walk. I was immobile for a while. So I was listening to the radio a lot. I was listening to Michigan radio a lot. And the reports were really, there was an onslaught of reports every day about what was happening in Flint. It was just really emerging. And what really enraged me were the reports about the children. They had been drinking lead-tainted water for months and months and months. And that, in particular, mobilized me. And as soon as I could walk and drive my car again, I just literally got in the car one day and drove to Flint. I live in Royal Oak, and it's about a 70-mile drive. And I just went there. I didn't have a plan in mind. I knew I wanted to do something productive.
There's a very short prelude at the beginning of the book that kind of sets the tone for what we're about to experience. Could you read it for us?
I'd be happy to. Have a blessed day, I'm told over and over again. I've never felt so blessed. Kindness bestowed by people too bereft of surplus to warrant such generosity. I'm grateful, but my gratitude is leavened with a liberal dash of liberal guilt. I wince despite myself every time I hear it uttered. Repetition dulls the sting. Liberated by banality, I mourn the loss.
I know a lot of people in Flint were profoundly aware of a wider world and a wider white world waking up to what was going on with them. Maybe there's something there that at least part of that feeling was reciprocated from folks who were coming to help. But, you know, a lot of people did have feelings like this, but not a lot of people actually went and did something in the physical world about it. I know what you're saying about feeling mobilized about the kids, but is there any other light you can shed on what led you to go and make this commitment?
Yeah, I grew up in the Detroit area in the late 50s, early 60s, and I came from a family from the South, and they arrived here with some inherent biases. And those biases are my biases, and I've spent my life trying to overcome them. And when I went to Flint, I arrived with certain assumptions. And one of them was that I was, you know, I have progressive attitudes. I have racial equanimity. But I was really fearful upon reflection of having those tested, of having that sense of equanimity tested. But part of my reasoning for going, I think, was to try to undo some of those early biases that I absorbed growing up in a house where I grew up.
And generally speaking, what did you find when you got to Flint? How did people react to you as you would show up at their door with cases of water?
Well, you know, it was to me, it was an odd situation. Normally, when you're a Red Cross disaster relief volunteer, you're responding to a natural disaster in a city or out in the country, and you're delivering food and water to people, and they tend to come to you. The city, their whole blocks are devastated. They tend to come to you, and you hand out the help. But in Flint, it was reversed. Our job, my job, was to deliver water to people who couldn't drive or didn't have the means to drive to one of the state-funded delivery sites. So, you know, we were knocking on doors and going into houses every day, and I can say without reservation, everybody was incredibly welcoming and friendly. People wanted to talk. It became a problem sometimes. You know, we really had to keep things moving to make sure we delivered, you know, all the water that we had to deliver that day. But it was really hard sometimes not to spend time just chatting with people and hearing their story. That became important to me.
It sounds like you had done some Red Cross work before.
No, I hadn't. I did very little research. I managed to find out that the Red Cross was the only portal to really volunteering in Flint officially. So that's where I went on my first day. When I drove to Flint, I went right to the Red Cross and went through a process and became a certified disaster relief volunteer, which allowed me to drive an emergency relief vehicle. They call it an ERV. People have seen them. They're the red and white boxy trucks that you see in disasters, you know, parked, handing out food and water.
The book is structured as vignettes, almost like a diary, interlayered with stories about your mom and sometimes your dad and your own childhood. It kind of leaves me with the impression that your mom was, even though you were doing this work that was certainly consuming and important and as you say, pretty interesting too, it seems like your mom was on your mind a lot in those days.
She was, as well as my father. I don't know that I can even explain it to this day, but going to Flint and spending the time that I spent there allowed me to start to look at some things about my family that I don't think I had really wanted to look at before I arrived. And it had a lot to do with her death, and I was in the middle of grieving. But also just grieving the relationship that the three of us had growing up. Maybe it's a function of age, too, but the vignette aspect of the book is a product of the way I started to write it. I was taking notes and wanting to preserve my memories, and I never set out to write a book. And before long, I realized I had quite a large volume of work, and I sent it to a local poet, Thomas Litch, whom I'm acquainted with, and he read it, and he thought it was okay, but he really thought it needed a catalyst, a parallel story to set it off and really create some tension. And so I took his advice.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Royal Oak-based poet David Harden. His recent memoir is called Standpipe, and it weaves together municipal and family trauma. I'd like to ask you to read again from the book. This is one of the later chapters that touches on both what was going on in Flint and also what was going on with you. Do you want to set it up?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. In 2015, the crisis had been evolving in Flint, and it was certainly not new to the people who lived there, but it was only beginning to emerge within the outside world. And I was, my mother really had taken a turn for the worst. And again, I was living in Royal Oak and going back and forth to Tennessee to try to attend to her, and her birthday was coming up, and the family gathered there together to celebrate her birthday. She was in a nursing home at the time. So I'll go ahead and read this. disaster is officially declared in Flint. It is 2015, well over a year since unsuspecting residents were first exposed to toxic levels of lead and biohazardous effluents. Tractor trailers full of donated bottled water arrive daily from points north, south, east, and west. Flint is world news, a symbol of the fraying fabric of American civic responsibilities and the nation's decaying infrastructure. Even Cher dispatches a semi or two. Residents are urged not to drink or bathe in unfiltered tap. The state provides filters for standard kitchen faucets, but not for tub or shower fixtures. Rumors abound that shower filters are available to the well-connected. Physicians treat patients for lead toxicity, rashes, and Legionella bacterial infection. Water for drinking, cooking, and bathing, for pets, medical care, teeth brushing, and ice, comes in 16-ounce bottles that end up filling thousands of recycling bags or accumulating in great glittering heaps in backyards and vacant lots. I hear the reports, make a mental note to investigate further, but fail to register the magnitude of the disaster. Truth is, I'm barely listening. We've planned a family reunion in Tennessee to celebrate Imanelle's upcoming birthday. She survived surgery, most of her small intestine removed, wheelchair-bound, alive, but greatly diminished. She's living in a nursing home 3 miles equidistant from the small farm where she grew up and her old condo. My brother and I have spent months driving back and forth arranging for her care, battling bureaucracy, tracking the decaying orbit of her life. She steadfastly refuses to rejoin us in Michigan. She seems to be losing her grip on reality, but outwardly remains optimistic and accepting of her circumstances. We haul in pizza, ice cream, and cake, enough for 20. But it's a Saturday, only a weekend skeleton crew on duty, essential personnel only. A couple of aides and a harried nurse wander through the common room. They politely decline cake, eye the pizza noncommittally. Group pictures are taken, old jokes rehashed, ribbing of the good-natured variety flows. We box leftovers, stash everything in the staff refrigerator, all of us due to fly out the following day. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear mother. Happy birthday to you. She'll be dead in a few weeks, one day shy of her 83rd birthday.
Thank you for reading that.
You're welcome.
What do you think it was about the journey to Flint that helped you sort out your thoughts about your mom and the end of her life? Was it just getting the perspective of something so much larger than one family, or just having the time while you were outside of your normal routine?
That's a great way to put it. It really got me out of my head. I was partly because I was grieving, partly because I was quarantined at home back at that time, kind of echoing the quarantine we're all doing now. I needed something to wake me up and get me out of my own funk. And you know, meeting people every time I was there and talking to them and finding out about their lives and about just what a struggle it is to live in Flint every day, even without a water crisis, allowed me to get beyond my own petty concerns.
I get a sense, reading the book, that maybe in the moment it felt easier for you to contemplate what was going on in Flint than to contemplate the problems that your mom had at the end of her life. I mean, her illness doesn't even really manifest until quite a few chapters into the book.
Well, that's it. And maybe I wasn't ready to deal with it, and Flint offered me a diversion, and that's a valid point. But I think if I hadn't have volunteered in Flint and hadn't had that experience, I'm not sure that I would have been prepared as soon as I was to really delve into the relationship we had, and things really didn't resolve it with her death. She died. We really never had any kind of reconciliation, one that I expected. Maybe I thought it was due me, but you know, that it doesn't always happen that way.
Why do you think it didn't happen?
Good question, and I'm not sure I can answer it in the time we have, but the short answer is that my mother and I both had to reach accommodation with my father, and in order to do that, we had to almost disavow the connection that we had early on, and we never were able to come back together and recover from that.
Could you say more about what you mean by that? That, like, that each of you couldn't step away from the relationships you had with him? So that made it impossible to have a relationship with each other?
Yeah. He was a man who struggled, I think, himself with his own emotions, and he really struggled with intimacy. And she had to accommodate that in her own life to such a degree that I wonder sometimes if it how that affected her ability to really relate to me, and vice versa. I had to make accommodations for him as well. Whether, you know, right or wrong, I think it prevented my mother and I from really maintaining a deep and evolving relationship as the years went by. And maybe I'm not explaining it in a sensical way, but maybe for now that's the best I can do.
David Harden's new memoir is called Standpipe, Delivering Water in Flint, available on Belt Publishing. David, thank you very much for talking with us about this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for being interested in the book. I appreciate it.
Next up, the thawing of the Great Lakes as seen through the lens of one Detroit photojournalist.
And if you look at ice patterns, we have high ice years and low ice years. But the trend is a downward trend.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A new exhibition of photography chronicling ice fishing, entitled Last Ice, explores how the number of frozen days has decreased dramatically on the Great Lakes over the past 40 years. The exhibition is open at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum on Detroit's Belle Isle, and you can see it through April 24th. The photos of not-so-solid lakes and people navigating warmer Michigan winters were taken by Detroit photojournalist Amy Sacca. Her photos on the subject were first featured in the September 2020 issue of National Geographic, and that's when we last spoke with Amy on Stateside. Let's listen to the conversation. Amy Sacca, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Was your family outdoors much in Michigan winters when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. Yes, my dad has ice fished on the Great Lakes for 50 years. So it's been a big part of our family tradition and culture for as long as I can remember.
What kind of winter memories do you have of being out on the ice?
Well, so this was something when I was growing up that was primarily my father's activity.
What, you weren't into getting out there and freezing your keister off in the shed? I'm shocked.
Well, it was much colder back then, right? And but so anyway, yeah, my memories as a kid were that he would, winter mornings were his, and it was his time to go out before the sun would rise. And he would come back around the time that we would wake up, and he would have all these fish. And it was a little bit of a mystery as to what he was doing out there. And I wasn't particularly interested in fishing at the time. So I'd be sleeping in, right? Waiting for breakfast. And so as I got older, I began a photography career, I became very interested in what his experience was like on the ice. And so about 4 years ago, I started to go out with him on the ice and photograph what he was up to and talk to other ice anglers on the ice. And I really saw Midwestern culture come to life. I was surprised. I wasn't aware of how much activity there is on the ice.
A couple of winters ago, you got a grant to work with National Geographic in which you drove around Michigan looking for lake ice. What did you find on that trip?
Well, that was a very interesting year because we had a lot of ice that year. And if you look at ice patterns, we have high ice years and low ice years. But the trend is a downward trend. And so that winter, I was able to get out on the ice quite a bit. And so I think I spent 70 days on the ice.
Yeah, it was a 10,000-mile road trip. It's just astonishing.
It was. And one of the things that I'm most proud of about that trip and that project is that I got the grant through iPhone photos that I had taken with my dad on Lake St. Clair the year before, and my dad and I had plotted out a path to write this grant. What could I do that was feasible in a short winter? And so I applied for the grant. I got it. It was the first time that I had worked with National Geographic. And my dad was a big part of following me along the journey, giving me advice on where to go. And so it really means a lot to me to bring attention to these issues. So that was the beginning of the project, and I wasn't sure if I would go on the ice again, but here we are.
Right.
A year or two later, and I was back out there.
And the conditions are starkly different.
They are.
What were the places that you wanted to go for this updated piece? Again, the first one was just an online. This actually appears in the magazine.
Sure. So I decided to go out on the ice again. I was actually doing a story for another outlet, and I couldn't find any ice. It was, I think, late January, and normally, or early January, normally there's ice on Lake St. Clair, at least at that point. So I went up to Lake Superior looking for it because I thought, I've got to get on the ice. And I thought for sure on Lake Superior there'd be something. But I got up there and I saw that there was no ice up there. And the first night I was there, I stayed in a cabin in Paradise, Michigan, and I talked to the owners, and they said, the only reason you could book a room in our cabin is because we had snowmobilers who were supposed to stay here. We were fully booked, but they had to cancel because there was no snow. And so I photographed the hotel owner. And as we were going around Lake Superior, I started photographing all the things that were happening around the open water and how people were adapting to the fact that there was no ice. So I photographed surfers. I photographed just people walking around in shorts. And so I decided at that point, what if I drove around all five of the Great Lakes and looked at how this trend is affecting different communities? And I took that idea to National Geographic, and they joined right along with me. And that's what I did last winter.
Now, the spread includes a satellite image of all five lakes taken in February, and none of them has very much ice on it. Do you have a sense of how new a phenomenon that is?
I would say it's in the past 20 years, there's been a real difference. Now, I think the entryway for me to this project was hearing the stories of fishermen like my father who remember growing up and being able to drive their cars across the ice. And that has dramatically changed. You cannot, there's no way you could do that today. And it was a repeated theme that I would hear from people was, we can't fish the way that we used to fish. And if you look at that satellite image, it's astonishing. I think it was taken in late February. That is prime fishing time. My father could not get out on the ice once.
Yeah.
Last year.
It looks like from the photos, there are many ways in which the cultural fabric of the state has been affected by there being less ice. You mentioned fishing, of course, tourism. There's this wonderful photo of the Shandy Days Festival in Caseville, and it just looks like a slush fest.
Yeah, actually, they were really lucky on that weekend to have a bit of ice. But
it's not much. Could you describe the image?
It is not. Yes. So they have a great polar bear dip that they do every year, and I have photographed it twice. And it's just a fun time for Michiganders to come out and enjoy the winter weather. And everybody puts on their swimsuits. And this particular image, there was a woman who was jumping in and her arms are outstretched. And it's a pretty dramatic photo. But I've got to tell you, if you look at those spreads, that's one of the only spreads where you can see some ice.
Yeah. Lake Erie is the shallowest of the Great Lakes, and some of the starkest images that you came up with came from Lake Erie. There's a gorgeous sunrise at Presque Isle State Park over a completely thawed pond in the middle of winter, a city park on a January day that barely even looks like winter. And then there's this one of a tween girl in Cleveland running around in her shorts in January. I mean, people, I can just tell you, people in Northeast Ohio, just like people in Michigan, joke about being A-OK with less ice. But what did you find people saying there about the changes?
Yeah, Lake Erie is one where we are, as you mentioned, it's a shallow lake. So the first time I did this project, that was my go-to lake. The ice is very thick when we have, high ice years. And so it was very strange to go to places like Breast Bay, where they draw walleye fishermen from everywhere to go on the ice, and there was no ice. And then as I went around the lake, as you mentioned, I met a girl named Gracie who was wearing shorts, and I ran up to her and she just said, it's just not cold enough. And then as I made my way around the lake, I looked out my window and I saw some hunters, and they were throwing decoys on the open water. And I stopped my car and I ran out there. And I said, would you mind if I sat with you for a while and talked with you? And they said, of course. And they were telling me that there was no way in prior years that they would be able to hunt that late in the season. And this was also a big snowmobiling community. And they said a lot of people in that area have had to sell their snowmobiles because they just can't do it anymore.
Mm. You're the woman who wrote the text story that accompanies your images is Alejandra Barunda. Did climatologists tell you or her anything that you didn't know before about some of the causes for the warmer temperatures that we're seeing?
I think the thing that was interesting for me was to learn about how many factors there are. There's a lot that goes into how the ice forms, when the ice forms, where you are on the different lakes. If you'll notice, the story in National Geographic opens in Manoscon, Michigan, and they're used to getting a lot of ice up there. The way that the ice is situated, it locks in there. So they're not experiencing that much. So it's interesting to talk to locals in different areas because some of them haven't experienced that as much. So it's very complicated to try to predict. I mean, if you read, some of the climatologists will predict what the ice level is going to be at the beginning of the season. And I think the first year I did the project, the outcome was radically different than what they had predicted.
We all understand that there are ecological costs of changes in the climate. For example, the costs of drought across the globe to humans and plants and animals. And we understand the cost of rising water levels to just about any community that's near water. But are there consequences for a lack of ice that you know of?
Well, I think from a recreation perspective, for sure. You see it in all the photos. But it's just, it's the fabric of our culture that for me is the most important thing, or the thing that I've seen just so dramatically affect who we are as Michiganders and our identity. And so to see someone like my dad not be able to do what he really enjoys doing, and to hear people talk about how they're worried about not being able to pass this tradition down, that is just really sad.
So if I may ask, is your dad still with us?
He is. He is.
And how are winters different for him these days?
I think it's fishing from the dock. It's fishing from the dock and just trying to be okay with not getting out there as much. One of the other things I wanted to mention that I saw quite a bit that you mentioned in what you were saying is that high water levels too. I mean, that is one of the other effects of not having as much ice, is the ice, without the ice to protect the shorelines, when you get storms coming in, it can cause a lot of damage with the levels of the water. And so almost everywhere I went on the Great Lakes, Lexington, Tawas. Homes are being destroyed there. The coastline is being eaten away. It's a really big concern.
Amy, what is it that you hope people take away from these images that you've captured of Michigan ice, or lack thereof?
Well, I would just like to encourage people to go out in the winter and listen to the sounds that the ice makes, to see the recreation that exists on the ice. It's almost like a whole other being. And you can sense the solitude and the power of nature when you're out there on the ice. And I think not enough people get out there and see what it's all about.
Amy Sacca is a photojournalist based in Detroit. Amy, thank you so much for the project. It's amazing to look at, and for all the work you did on it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Amy Sacca's ice fishing photography exhibit, entitled Last Ice, is on display at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum on Detroit's Belle Isle through April 24th. Former Michigan Attorney General Frank Kelly died late last Friday. He was 96. Kelly is remembered not only for what he did as Attorney General, but for how long he served the state in that office. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports.
People like to call Frank Kelly the Eternal General. Kelly served as Michigan Attorney General for longer than anyone else, from his appointment in 1961 to his retirement in 1998. In those 37 years, Kelly went from being Michigan's youngest ever Attorney General to being the oldest man ever to hold the post. In all, Kelly was elected 10 times. Kelly's most enduring achievement was establishing consumer protection and environmental protection divisions within the Attorney General's office.
There was no such thing as consumer protection when I started. The words weren't even in general use. Environmental protection was not in general use. There wasn't one environmental lawyer of distinction in Michigan or in the country when I started.
One of Kelly's successors as Michigan Attorney General, Bill Schutte, says consumer protection is a key part of Kelly's legacy.
Because of this commitment to consumer protection, it's a part of every division of attorneys general across America. So that's a terrific statement and testament to Frank's durability and his qualities.
A Democrat, Kelly served with five Michigan governors of both parties. He said he was most proud of his ability to work with both sides of the aisle, something he said was sadly missing in Lansing today.
Politics is something that's based on compromise. Our idea of government in America, democracy, is based on compromise. And too many people today don't realize that. And so you should not only compromise, but you should remain friends and not be bitter over anything. We had that back in my day. We don't have it today.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer knew Frank Kelly much of her life, starting from the time her mother worked in the Attorney General's office as a secretary. She says one result of term limits is that fewer current state lawmakers are aware of Frank Kelly's bipartisan approach.
I do think with term limits, you know, and the continual changeover in our legislature, that maybe not enough people know what kind of public servants we used to have and what the standard really should be and how important it is to find common ground when we can.
On a cold October day in 2013, many of Frank Kelly's colleagues, old friends and others, gathered to name the walkway that connects the state capitol to the complex of state office buildings and the state Supreme Court building after Frank Kelly. Kelly himself used the occasion to sum up his feelings about life with a quote from Anne Frank.
I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart.
Though the politician in Kelly couldn't help adding,
I also think that all of you should be very grateful today, because this is the shortest speech that I ever made. Thank you very much.
I'm Steve Carmody.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you Tuesday.